If you have your Bibles, will you open to Jonah chapter 1? Jonah chapter 1, verses 7 through 17 this morning. A couple of weeks ago, we began this new series called Jonah and the Mission of God. I believe that this book of Jonah, it's in the Old Testament. Jonah is between, in history of events, between David and Daniel. And I believe the story of Jonah often gets overlooked. It's dismissed as a kid's story, or it's written off as, oh, I already know that story. There's not much there for me. And there's not a lot of practical things in my life there. And so what I want to encourage you is I actually believe there is a lot of practical wisdom in this ancient story for our lives. So I want to encourage you this morning to look at the story of Jonah with fresh eyes. Jonah was a prophet in the 8th century BC under King Jeroboam II. His job was to go around and tell people messages from God. He was a prophet. He was God's spokesperson. But God gave him an assignment to go to Nineveh. Nineveh was on the banks of the Tigris River in what is now Mosul, Iraq. And it was he called him to go to Nineveh there. It was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And the Ninevites were not good people. The Ninevites were actually really rough people. They would torture people. They did not treat people well. They were famous for their cruelty. And they were the enemy of Israel. And Jonah didn't want to go. He said, God, I don't want to go to these people. And so instead of going on to the people that God assigned him to go to, he ran away. He didn't listen to God. He ran away. He went down to a city called Joppa, where he found a boat. He went, talked to the captain of the boat, and paid him enough money that the captain let him on the boat to go where they were going. He said, where are you going? He said, Tarshish, which is in the southern part of Spain, the opposite way of Iraq, where Nineveh was. And he heads that way. And as soon as he gets on the boat, they get out to sea. God sends a storm, Category 5 hurricane, to come and get Jonah's attention and wake him up. But what is Jonah doing in the midst of a Category 5 hurricane? He's asleep in the bottom of the boat. And then we found out a couple of weeks ago that the captain goes down and wakes him up and says, arise, Jonah, get up. There's a storm. Jonah is going to come to the top of the boat with the rest of the sailors this morning. The storm is raging. I want you to picture this. Lightning, thunder, wind, waves crashing to the boat, that the boat is threatening to break apart. It's a loud scene. And in the midst of that loud scene of waves crashing, rain pelting down, there's a conversation that's going to happen at the top of the boat. And that's where we pick up our story in Jonah chapter 1, verses 7 through 17. I'll read our text. And they said to one another, this is the sailors, come, let us cast lots, that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What's your occupation? And where do you come from? What is your country? And of what people are you? And he said to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, what is it that you have done? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us? For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, pick me up and hurl me out into the sea. Then the sea will quiet down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land. But they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life. And lay not on us innocent blood for you. O Lord, you have done as it pleased you. So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea. And the sea ceased from raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly. And they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. What an incredible story. What an incredible story here in Jonah chapter 1. And I believe that there are things we're going to discover this morning that are incredible. Practical things for our lives. 5 things from this ancient story I want us to notice. But overall, I want us to just notice that God's grace shows up in some of the most surprising places. God's grace shows up in some of the most surprising places. 5 things I want us to see this morning. The first is we'll see a question of identity. A question of identity. I don't know about you, but I love whodunit mysteries. Y'all know what a whodunit mystery is? It's a whodunit mystery is one where the reader of a story or the viewer of a show is trying to figure out who committed the crime. Someone gets murdered in the opening scene, and then everyone else is trying to figure out who done it, right? My mom loved whodunit mysteries. She loved Murder, She Wrote. Any of y'all ever seen Murder, She Wrote? So that was Jessica Fletcher, played by Angela Lansbury. A few years ago, Jennifer, my wife and I, were in Washington, D.C., and went to see a play starring Angela Lansbury, okay? Angela Lansbury was 90, starring in a play. That's my new life goal, right? It was incredible. What was funny in the play was that she had to actually play dead a couple times. And everybody was worried, like, is she going to get up this time, right? And so she did a great job. And so it was really funny. But we, this idea of whodunit, in Murder, She Wrote, everybody's trying to figure out who committed the crime. And I think that's exactly what's going on in the top of the boat. They're trying to say, whodunit? Whose account? Who did something to make some god? Because remember, these pagan sailors, remember, they believed in a lot of gods at this point. And they're saying, who offended their god that brought this kind of storm upon us? Who done it? Who is the culprit? And a question of identity comes. Verse 7. They said to one another, come, let us cast lots, that we may know on whose account the evil has come. Find out who done it. So they cast lots, and they fell on Jonah. So they figure out who it is. Then they begin to ask him some questions. Verse 8, they said to him, tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. Then they asked him 3 personal questions about his identity. First, what is your occupation? What's your job, Jonah? What do you do? Second, where do you come from? What's your country? And third, of what people are you? What race? What ethnicity are you? What's your job? Where do you come from? What people are you from? What's your race? These are normal questions. We often ask this question. We say, what do you do? Well, I'm an accountant, or I'm a teacher, or something like that. We say, where are you from? And I always tell people I'm from Arkansas, and they always kind of look funny. But I had somebody this morning tell me they knew where I was from. And so that was incredible. I'm from such a small town that people from Arkansas don't even know where it is, right? And so, but you ask, where are you from? Ask him where he's from. And how does Jonah answer? What does he begin with? They ask, what's your job? What's going on here? He says, I am a Hebrew. Okay, Jonah, you're a Hebrew. Okay, we got it. Most scholars say he didn't answer the questions in the order that they asked, because what was most central to Jonah's identity but his racial and ethnic pride? It's why he didn't want to go to the Ninevites, right? He had a problem with racism in his heart and ethnocentrism in his heart, and so Jonah doesn't want to go to the Ninevites. He doesn't like other people, and he says, the most basic part of my identity, I'm a Hebrew. But you know, we often do that too. What's the most basic part of our identity? Is it that you're an accountant? No, because that could be taken away, isn't it? It's not that you are even married or not married. That can be taken away. It's not your relationships like that that define you ultimately. Those things can be taken away. What is the core thing that defines you as who you are? Well, I want to tell you that if you are in Christ, the most important thing that tells you who you are is not what you do. The most important thing about who you are is that you are an adopted child of God. The most important thing about you is not even who you are, it's whose you are, who you belong to. You see, the most important thing about you isn't who you are, it's about who your Father is. And you are a child of the High King of Heaven. These questions of identity, he's asking, who is he? He says, well, it begins with the most central part of who he is. He thinks he's a Hebrew. Often we base our identity on the things we do, but we must base our identity on who God has declared us to be. But you see here, he says, I'm a Hebrew, and then he goes and says, I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and dry land. Now, normally in the Hebrew, they say the land and the sea. But he flips it. He says, listen, guys, y'all want to know what God I serve? I serve the God who made the sea and the land. You serve the God who made the sea and the land? Yeah, that's the God I serve. What Jonah is telling them is, hey guys, the one who's doing this storm, the one who's in control of everything, that's my God. The one who's raining down judgment upon us, that one's mine. That's who I worship. The one who has the power over the Category 5 hurricane that is coming after us, that's the one I serve. So, we see Jonah's admitting these things. But he answers, but he never answers their original question, does he? Do you notice that? His original question, their original question to him, what's your occupation? He never answers. He never answers what his job is. Why? Jonah has a clear job. It's one to be proud of. I am the prophet of the Most High God. I could see that being a pretty big, nice way to intro yourself in a room. Ask him what his job is. He doesn't have anything to say. Because God had called him to be a prophet of the Most High God and take the message of judgment and grace to the Ninevites, and yet he has run so far away that he has forgotten his job. He has forgotten his mission. He has forgotten his calling, or at least he's ashamed of it, and he doesn't even mention it. So we see Jonah, there's a question of identity, and now they know who it is. The question is, will he admit what he's done? Point number two, we'll find an admission of guilt. An admission of guilt. Let's read in verse 10. Will there be a confession? Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, what is this that you have done? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may quiet down for us? For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, pick me up and hurl me into the sea, and the sea will quiet down for you. And catch this, for I know it is because of me that the great tempest has come upon you. Jonah owns it, doesn't he? He knows he's guilty. He gives a complete and full confession. He's been running from God, and he knows that the storm has come because of his action. And the storm hasn't just come upon him, it's come upon those guys in the ship, those innocent men. But the truth is, if we're honest, we're not very good at admitting our own guilt sometimes, are we? When we sin, when we sin against somebody or against God, we typically have four options. When we do something wrong, and we all do from time to time, when we do something wrong, we have four options. We can try to ignore it and just pretend it didn't happen. We can blame others and say it was so, well, it's actually your fault that I had to do that, because if you would have done that, I wouldn't have had to do this. No one's ever had that conversation before, right? In your marriages? So, all right? Or we try to justify it. Well, if you only understood what I had to do at work, that meant you would understand why I had to do this. If you understood the pressure I was under, you would understand why I was not more kind with you. We try to make excuses, we justify it, or fourth, like Jonah, we can own it. See, Jonah could have said here, you know what, I'm just going to ignore this. I'm going to ignore it, I'm going to ignore the storm, I'm just going to ignore it all. I'm going to act like I didn't do anything wrong. Or Jonah could have blamed others. He could have said, listen, I know that I'm running from God, and I know the storm's coming from me, but, I mean, who are these guys in the boat after all? They're pagan sailors. Maybe it's their fault that the storm's come upon me. They haven't been worshiping God. I'm his prophet. Maybe it's the pagans that are the problem and not me. Maybe it's their sin that's brought this and not mine. Or maybe he started justifying it. Maybe he could have said, listen, there are so many lost people in Tarshish. I think God's missionary work would be better in Tarshish anyways. And so I'm actually helping God out by running to Tarshish. And he begins to justify it. No, that's not what Jonah does. He doesn't ignore it. He doesn't blame others. He's not justifying it. Instead, he owns it. And I want you to know that it is a sign of spiritual maturity to own your sin. Sometimes we think that we only confess our sin when we get saved the first time, when we come to know Christ. But the mark of someone who is growing in Christ is they continually confess their wrongdoings to their spouse, to their children, to their parents, to their friends, to their God. You see, one sign that you are growing spiritually is that it takes less time to admit you're wrong than it did before. That's a sign of growth in grace. That it takes less time for you to admit you were wrong than it did before. The Christian life does not mean that we're never going to be wrong. But the Christian life isn't marked with always being right, but it is marked by quicker and quicker admitting that we were wrong. He admitted he was guilty. This is one of the surprising places where we find grace in this text. Where does grace meet Jonah? Right in his confession. I want you to know this morning that when we celebrate the Lord's Supper here in a little bit, I want to encourage you, do not come and take the bread and the juice with unconfessed sin in your heart. I want to encourage you, confess it. I want to have a newsflash for you. God already knows what you thought. He already knows what you did. He already knows what you wish you would have done. He already knows all of your junk and all of your mess. But until you confess it, it has power over you. So I want to encourage you, confess it. Run to the Lord. He will forgive you every time. You may say, no, Pastor. You don't know how many times I have committed to God and I have failed. It doesn't matter. God will forgive you as many times as you need it. So I want to encourage you, confess your sin this morning. You can't find healing until you learn to admit you're guilty, to own it. They say in support groups that the first step to help is admitting you have a problem, right? The first step to a healthy marriage is being able to confess your sin to one another. The first step to a healthy relationship with God is being willing to confess your sin to Him. The first sign of being a healthy Christian is that you are not holding on to the guilt, but confessing it, knowing that Jesus died for those very things. So I encourage you to own your sin. So they knew Jonah was it. They found out who done it. He admitted to it. So he's added an admission of guilt. Now what was going to happen? Jonah said, well, throw me overboard. Throw me overboard. What would the sailors do? We find out in point number 3, a substitutionary sacrifice. A substitutionary sacrifice. Verse 13. These men weren't so sure about throwing him overboard. We're not sure why. Maybe they think, if his God is big enough to send this storm, we're not sure about throwing him overboard. Or maybe there's just a sailor code. We don't abandon people and throw them overboard. All right, but whatever reason, they don't want to. Verse 13. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to the dry land. But as hard as they rowed, they couldn't get back. For the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood for you. O Lord, have done it as it pleased you. So what did they do? They picked up Jonah. And you can imagine the scene on this boat. Maybe it's a high wall there they have to get him over. So they pick Jonah up. Several men carry him. And they throw Jonah overboard. And all they hear is splash. And as soon as they do, the sea stops raging. The storms stop. What's going on here? You see, water in the Bible is a powerful image. Water is the symbol of judgment. You remember the flood? Y'all remember the flood when Noah on the ark, the flood waters came down as a sign of judgment on the earth? Do you remember the Exodus where the Egyptians are chasing after the people of God and Moses parts the seas and then the Egyptians walk through and the water collapses in judgment over the Egyptians? Water is a sign of judgment. And what is going on here? Jonah understands he's going to die. God's judgment has found him. He's guilty. He's the culprit. He deserves the judgment. So what's going to happen? Jonah knows he's going to die. And so he says, okay, I'm going to die. And it's either I die on the ship along with all of these sailors, or they throw me overboard and the sailors live. And Jonah has compassion. Jonah says, there's no need for every one of us to die, so throw me overboard that you might be saved. Jonah knew the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, that sometimes that they would take the sins of the people, put their hands on a goat, and transfer the sins to the goat. He understood that these goats would die in the place of the people as the symbolism of sacrifice for them. And so, he understood this principle of substitutionary sacrifice. So Jonah is saying, let me be sacrificed that you might be saved. Let me be thrown out into the waters of judgment because I'm guilty. Let me be thrown into those waters of judgment that you and the boat might be spared. And so they do. They take him, they throw him into the water. And the Bible tells us in the New Testament that this incident is pointing forward. And it was a foreshadow of what Jesus would do for us. But here's the thing. There's something very different about this picture and the picture of Jesus, of what Jesus did for us. This picture's forward, it foreshadows, but there's some differences too. So what's going on here? Think about this. In this story, you have the guilty one is thrown into the waters of judgment to save the innocent people. Y'all tracking with me on that? The guilty one is thrown overboard into the waters of judgment that those in the boat, the innocent ones, might be saved. So the guilty is thrown overboard that the innocent one might be saved. So when the guilty is thrown over, the judgment goes upon him and on Jonah, that those in the boat, the judgment stops, and they have safety. But in the gospel, it's the exact reverse, right? It's the innocent one who is thrown into the waters of judgment upon the cross, that not the innocent might be free, but because the guilty one, the innocent one is thrown into the waters, that the guilty might go free. Do y'all see the reverse? In Jonah, the guilty one goes in to save the innocent, but at the cross, the innocent one goes to the cross that the guilty ones might go free. Do you see this? This is incredible and important. So imagine we are those in the boat. The judgment is coming towards us. We are the ones who deserve God's wrath, God's judgment. We are the ones who deserve the storm to come and to ultimately not just throw us into the waters of judgment, but to throw us into the waters of hell, into the judgment of hell. But what Jesus is saying is instead of them having to go into the judgment of hell, throw me upon the cross instead, because I will be declared, I, the innocent one, Jesus is saying, will go to the cross and be declared guilty on the cross, that they, the guilty ones, might be declared innocent by my blood. So, what this is pointing forward is what God will do for you. That you, though were guilty, and you deserve to be thrown out of the boat, Jesus is the one who ultimately will go to the cross, die in your place for your guilt, that you might be safe from God's wrath and God's judgment. You see, the guilty one is declared to be innocent by the blood of Jesus. In the story of Jonah, Jonah's guilty. He's thrown overboard to save the innocent. But at the cross, the innocent one dies under the judgment of God to save the guilty. He is our substitutionary sacrifice. So they throw him overboard. He begins to sink, to drown, to receive his judgment. So Jonah splashes. He's sinking into the water. Press pause on Jonah for a second, and let's go back to the boat. And we'll see point number four, a worshipful response. A worshipful response. What are these men going to do now that the storm has ceased? Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. So what'd they do on the boat? After they throw Jonah over, he's sinking, he's drowning. What do the men do on the boat? They have a worship service. They have a worship service on the boat. They start making sacrifices and make vows. What does that mean? They are pledging their allegiance to Yahweh, the one true God. Now, some wonder if this was genuine. Some wonder if maybe they're just trying to appease the gods. But I don't think that's it. This seems to be a genuine conversion to me, and here's why. Many people will make a deal with God in the midst of a storm, won't they? Many people will get a diagnosis from God, or from a diagnosis from the doctor, and they'll go to God and make a deal with him. God, if you'll get me through this, I will start tithing more. Right? God, if you will get me through this, I will even volunteer at VBS. God, if you will get me through this, I will serve you. And people often, in the midst of a storm, will make a deal with God where they say, God, if you will do this for me, I will do that for you. But notice, these men are not making a deal with God in the midst of the storm. When are they pledging their allegiance to God? After they've been delivered. After they've already received their rescue. They are worshiping in response to who God is and what He's done for them. The Psalms tell us that we are to sing, to clap, to shout, to dance for joy as we worship God. Because we were the guilty ones who have been declared innocent. We are the ones who were dead but now are alive. We were orphans but now we're adopted children of the King. We deserve the waters of judgment, but now we get the waters of blessing. And so, brothers and sisters, I want you to know very clearly this morning, God will be with you in whatever storm you go through. But don't forget about Him after He's delivered you. It is so easy to cry out to God in the midst of the storm, and once He's delivered you, back to my old life. God will be with you in the storm, child of God, but don't forget about Him after He's delivered you and the seas are calm. These men didn't. They worshiped Him. So there's a worship service breaking out in this boat of these pagan sailors now pledging their allegiance to the one true God. And we press pause, but let's go back to overboard to the water where Jonah is sinking. If you're reading this story for the first time and you don't know what's going to happen, you should can expect Jonah's going to go into the water and he's going to drown and he's going to die. And you would say, what's the moral of the story? You get what you deserve. But that's not the story God is telling, is it? God is not telling the you get what you deserve story. So what happens to him? We see a surprising rescue. Point number five. A surprising rescue. So Jonah hits the water, splash, and he begins to sink. And Jonah is thinking, this is the end. This is the end. This is the end. I'm going to drown. It is going to be over. Verse 17. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Isn't it amazing? That before the world was created, God had planned this fish to be there. The boat was so off course. It had been beaten and it had gone so far off course that the sailors didn't know where they were anymore. But God had sent the GPS coordinates to this fish to be exactly where Jonah was going to be hurled out of the boat, and right where he was hurled out the boat, exactly right GPS coordinates, God has a fish ready to swallow him up. But here's the thing. Sometimes people think the fish in this story is God's judgment. The fish in this story is not God's judgment. Think about this. What is judgment in this story? It's the water. Jonah is being thrown over into the water as the judgment, and he is looking to go to his death in the waters of judgment, but he thinks it is the end, but God has another plan. Right there waiting is God's rescue fish, ready to swallow him up from the judgment. God's rescuing him by swallowing him up. God's grace hits us in some surprising places, and I'm pretty sure Jonah didn't think he was going to meet the grace of God in the belly of a fish. But if it takes getting into the belly of a fish to meet the grace of God, brothers and sisters, it's worth it. You see, waiting right there as he's thrown overboard, he thinks it's the end, he thinks it's over. God is telling Jonah, it's not over yet. I'm not done with you yet, Jonah. I still have a purpose for you. Brothers and sisters, I want you to know, God still has a purpose for you. You may be thinking, Jonah, I'm just too messed up. Can God really use me? Jonah has been the rebel prophet, but God's not done with him yet. I don't care what you've done in your past, God's not done with you yet. You may be saying, maybe I'm the exception. All right, y'all want to know the God's not done with you test? You take two fingers and you put it on your wrist. Right? If you can find something, he ain't done with you yet. He is not done with you. He has a plan for you, a purpose for you, a calling for you. And you know what Jonah didn't answer? What is his job? God's about to remind him and help him answer that question again and remind him that he is the prophet of the Most High God, and he has a calling to go tell the gospel to the Ninevites. See, God is getting his attention through this, and he's reminding him he is not done with him yet. God's grace meets us in some surprising places. It meets us in our confession of sin. It meets us here in this fish, reminding him that God's not done with him yet. This morning, in just a few minutes, we're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. And as we celebrate it, I pray that it reinforces these things that we've learned today from this ancient story. Because this ancient story is pointing forward. I pray this reminds you of your identity. Reminds you of whodunit. The answer is Jesus Christ. Because he is the one who became guilty that you might be declared innocent. I pray that He will tell you that there is freedom to confess your sin and your guilt. And it's actually the path to healing. That you will be reminded of your substitutionary sacrifice, that the innocent one became guilty that you might be declared innocent. That Jesus was the one who was thrown overboard that we might be saved. And that you will realize that we must worship Him because we've been delivered. And I want you to be reminded as you eat this bread and drink this cup that it is proof God is not done with you yet. He has a purpose for you. He has a calling for you. And He wants you to live for Him. In 1 Corinthians, in the classic Lord's Supper passage, it ends with, it says, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until He comes." As you come in a few moments and you eat and you drink, what the Bible says you are doing is preaching. You're going to get to be a preacher this morning, right? It says you're preaching. You're preaching to two people. You're preaching to yourself, and you're reminding yourself, "I am a sinner saved by grace." And you're preaching to the world, "I am a sinner saved by grace." So this morning, as we come, let us not forget that we're preaching to ourselves and to one another. God's grace meets us in surprising places. Jonah never thought that the grace of God would meet him in a fish. And we never thought that the grace of God would be most seen on an old rugged cross outside of Jerusalem on a hill called Calvary. But that's exactly where we find the grace of God. Let's pray together. Father, I pray this morning that you will remind us of our true identity. That you will help us confess any unconfessed sin in our lives. May we not ignore our sin. May we not blame others. May we not try to justify ourselves. May we own it and freely admit where we've messed up. Remind us of the substitutionary sacrifice that Jesus went to the cross to die in our place. Help us respond in worship. And remind us that God is not done with us yet, that He has a purpose and He has a mission for us.